I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 145 of Caropop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. This is a very special Caropop episode because its genesis came out of a conversation with a Caropop guest just a few weeks ago, when I was talking with guitarist Jimmy James of Parlor Greens and the True Loves for episode 143. He cited Steve Cropper of Booker T and the MGs as a key inspiration for his playing. This makes sense. When you listen to James's work with the organ trio Parlor Greens, and before that, the Delvon Lamar Organ Trio, you hear how he, like Cropper, is a rhythmic guitarist who never overplays, yet when the moment is right, can make your head spin. I told James that I'd love to hear him interview Cropper, and he said that would be a dream come true. As it so happens, the 82-year-old Cropper and his band, The Midnight Hour, have a new album coming out August 23rd called Friendly Town. It features performances by Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top and Brian May of Queen, and of course, it spotlights that wonderful Steve Cropper guitar. In the summer of 2023, Cropper was my guest for Caropop episode 93. Though our focus mostly was on Otis Redding and the late soul singer's music that Cropper produced and often co-wrote. This time I pitched the idea of Jimmy James talking with Steve Cropper, guitarist to guitarist, generation to generation. James is a real student of funk, soul, rock, and blues guitar, and loves Cropper's guitar playing, not just on Booker T and the MG's hits, such as Hip Hugger, Time Is Tight, and Green Onions, but also on songs such as Johnny Taylor's 1968 hit Who's Making Love and Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour, which Cropper co-wrote. Cropper Hero also talks about his work with Sam and Dave and Otis Redding. James, with his Fender Jazzmaster in his lap, plays some of his own riffs as well, including his Cropper-esque turn on the new Parlor Green song, West Memphis. This conversation begins with Jimmy James and I talking about Cropper's work, and then Cropper comes in and everything goes to another level. It's such a treat to hear these two guitar greats swap insights about playing guitar in an organ-led band, how they come up with their parts, and how they approach their work. They have amazing stories to tell about some of the greatest music ever made. Please enjoy this Caropop conversation with Steve Cropper and Jimmy James.
One of the songs I remember listening to that Steve Cropper played on was my first inclination to him was Who's Making Love by Johnny Taylor. And I was 6 years old. And my taste at six was pretty much a trip because I liked what, you know, my mother and my great aunt and all them were playing. Because I remember my great aunt used to drop me off to class, to the kindergarten, right, in the morning. And that song, I remember that song being on the radio. And I just remember hearing it like...
Right.
You know what I mean? And that song stuck to me as a kid. So it was just like, and it's in my mother's record collection. I still have all her records, my grandmother's records, all that, you know. And so it was a lot of just hearing that. And then, you know, she had the Otis Redding stuff, you know, she liked These Arms of Mine, you know, and stuff like that, you know. And that was another one. Of course, Steve Cropper played on that one.
Right.
But it was just a lot of that stuff, you know, and just listening to what he played, you know. And then, of course, come now, West Memphis, you know, and it's just that, you know, that, which you could probably compare to, you know what I mean?
Right.
You probably compare to Soul Man, you know. And so even though I wasn't thinking about it, but it was, you know, in the back of the psyche, you know, and stuff like that. And so, but yeah, and my mother being funny because she was a big Sam and Dave fan too, you know, and hearing what's that? Let me see if I can remember it.
Hey, it's Steve. Oh, is it?
Yep. But Something's Wrong With My Baby, you know?
Right.
And she loved that song. She loved that and Soothe Me. Yeah, just listening to that, Knock on Wood, Eddie Floyd, Midnight Hour. Is that it? I can't remember. Yeah. you know, in the midnight hour. I know he co-wrote, I think he co-wrote that too, you know, and stuff like that.
Dock of the Bay, that's, co-wrote. He produced a lot of that late Otis stuff and was writing with them too.
Yeah, it's funny that this came up because one of the guys we were playing for, it was his last day in town, and he's from Georgia. And I said, I know a song you like, you know. He's like, and so we played them, you know, doing that, and you know, but we had to do Sit on Dr. Bay, and I was trying to double both parts, like trying to play the acoustic guitar part, and then I was like, I'm leaving one out because I got to do this, and so it was like, he has a huge catalog, you know, of stuff, and so it's just.
When you started playing, were you trying to sound like him?
There was a lot of people I was trying to go after at that time. It was not only him, like Steve Cropper, Chuck Berry, Pat O'Hare, B.B. King, Albert King, of course, and he played on, Steve Cropper played on Born Under a Bad Sign, playing that rhythm figure in there. And there was a lot of Freddie King. I was trying to, you know, mostly I always try to go after the blues players and those rhythm and blues players, which, you know, is still like, I still am trying to figure that out, you know, still to this day, because I hear things and I'm like, whoa, what went through their mind when they played that, you know, and stuff like that. So it's, you know, even like Reggie Young, that was another guy that most people wouldn't talk about, but most people know that he played this. Son of a Preacher Man. And,
right.
And funny story be told, actually, Son of a Preacher Man, what I read was, it was originally written for Aretha Franklin, and she turned it down just because the song title, you know, was kind of risque, and she turned it down.
So, well, and she was a daughter of a preacher man, so, you know, that might have affected you.
Right. She turned it down, but it's funny because listening to it, it's like you can tell it's the Muscle Shoals guys and all that in the back, and also you can hear the sweet inspirations because I can hear Sissy Houston singing that high upper register in there. And it's funny, Aretha would later cover it later, you know, after the fact, but
right.
It was always those session guys who always did it for me. Teeny Hodges, you know, from the, you know, the from Royal, you know, High Rhythm Section, that's what they call it. It was always those guys, you know, it was always those guys who were just like, did they, somebody put a chart in their face? Would, you know, they just, oh, this worked. What was going through their head? You know, that's the question I always wanted to ask, you know.
The whole session musician thing is kind of fascinating to me. I mean, Booker T and the MGs backed so many, you know, they were just the house band for Stax. So they're playing on all those Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and everything else, you know, but then they're doing their own stuff too in their own Booker T and the MGs and so songs. So you have like these sessions where you're trying to do the best thing for this artist, but then, you know, while also still being creative, and then you have the stuff that you're doing on your own. And, you've done this too. It's like, you know, are you approaching the material differently when you're in one mode than the other?
I would say so. Cause it's like the thing that I would throw out there is you're there to serve the music and not yourself. What is best for the artist, you know? And it's funny because Booker T was, and MGs was one of the very few studio bands that were able to make their own album and go on tour.
Right.
Like, you know, the Stax Volt tour they did in Europe, that clip of all that stuff was off the top, like, you know, just listening to it. And then, you know, when they backed up Otis Redding and Monterey Pop, you know, it's like the two best people, like, at that time, it's like, imagine being in that room, and it's like, okay, Otis comes out there with Sam Cooke's Shake, you know, and then Jimi Hendrix is just returning to America. It must have just been mind-blowing at that time to hear that. And I love that Otis got up there. He said, I'm going to do this song that a little girl took from me, but I'm going to do it my way. And he was talking about Aretha.
Right, just going back to respect.
And, you know, and I'm sure his family's still living off the royalties off of that, you know, but imagine in 1967 when it was at that time to see that Otis just doing that, Janis doing her thing. I mean, you know, Mamas and Papas, I mean, the list could go on and on and on. And it's just incredible. And I love watching that Otis Redding clip because I like when they do, do These Arms of Mine, and then he hits the stop. He's like, he asks them, do that one more time. And they're like, da-da, bah, da-da, bah. Let me do that one more time. Da-da, bah, da-da, bah. And they kept doing it, and then he sells it back down again, you know. And it just watching that, between that and watching a lot of those clips, because I love watching a lot of those clips, you know. Absolutely. Stuff like that, even.
Yeah, I picked up the Criterion Collection Blu-ray of that the Monterey Pop recording, and it's got like of the film, and it's got a separate disc which just has the full Otis on there. Yeah, like yeah, I've been loving you too long. It's crazy on there too. Right. And
that's what I meant. I'm sorry, loving you too long. That's the one I meant. I'm sorry, I said these songs about. That's the one he was playing.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. Dang, it's been hot out this summer, and there's no better way to cool off than with Cold Time. It's never pasteurized, and it's brewed low and slow in a method that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Hey, Steve. I was just talking with Jimmy James from this band Parlor Greens and True Loves, and before that, also the Del Von Lamar Organ Trio, and this fantastic guitarist. And we were talking about, you know, he's talking about you as an influence a few weeks ago. And then I knew you had a new record coming out, Friendly Town. I was like, well, maybe I could figure out a way to get him to talk to you about what you guys do. And I could just sort of moderate and sit back and enjoy the two, you know, awesome guitar players talking to each other. So Jimmy, Steve, you are hereby introduced to each other.
Hello, Mr. Crawford.
There you go. Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, man? I didn't know you were such a fan. That's great. Appreciate it.
Yeah. No, I'm a huge fan. Like, I have, I'm really sad, nervous right now, but I was listening to a track you did with the Astors. You did a song called Candy.
Right.
And I was like, I listened to that a lot. And I think also you played on Who's Making Love by Johnny Taylor. Sam and Dave, Johnny Taylor, the stuff you played on with Rufus Thomas.
Oh, I love that. I always said Johnny Taylor is one of the best singers in sex ever signed.
Yeah.
He might be better than Otis. They said he's better than Otis. I said, well, he didn't sell more records than Otis, but he might have been a better singer than Otis. Otis is not a singer. He was a groove. Mm-hmm. He could be better than anybody. But yeah. He also could carry a tune, too. He was a good pitch man. He could run across the stage and never lose a note.
Mm-hmm. I was telling Mark when I was about 6 years old, my great aunt used to play Johnny Taylor. She used to play that album. And that's how, wow, I got hit to where you were playing and, you know, and stuff like that. And my late mother, too, like a lot of her records, you know, and the stuff that she played, you know, because she was a big Sam and Dave fan. Listened to a lot of Carla Thomas, you know, Rufus Thomas, Walking the Dog was one of the songs I used to at least try to attempt to play, just like listening to it. And I was telling Mark in the group, the Parlor Greens, subconsciously, I like, what are your, I guess I hear this all the time, because one of the tunes we play is called West Memphis. And okay. the part, if you don't mind, I'll play it. You probably tell me what you think, but I have to play this part that's like, and I play this, you know what I mean? And
all right.
That's just, that's one of the things I like. It was just like influence from you as well, you know, on that. So Yeah.
That's a funny. So I say in my show, I do that in my show. I always close the show with it. But the thing is, I said, I didn't write this song. Hazel Porter wrote the song. But I've been the other half of Player most of my life. Player, see, I said, I've been the other half of Player. Player, Steve. That's three words, but I use the other half. Steve is the other half. The bottom half. Player is one word.
Play it, Steve. Yeah. Jimmy's got a Fender Jazzmaster, right? That's on his lap. So that's what he's.
Well, that's one of my favorite guitars, one of Roger Stewart's favorite guitars. And we wrote a song with Mike, what's his name, that wrote the ballad for Bonnie Raitt. And we wrote a song called Beyond the Storm for Winona. And she's in New York. She said, I've got it on my bed right now. I'm going to cut it tomorrow. Okay. She never did cut it. I still have the song on my desk, Beyond the Storm. It's a great song. And Marty got a woman to sing, a female to sing it and make a demo of it. So we sent it to people, and they turned it down a few times. They didn't think they're good enough to sing it, or the singer or not. Bullshit. If Bonnie can sing it, anybody can sing it. She's great. Bonnie Raitt is one of the rated, I'm her biggest fan. She has no idea that I love her to death. I turned her down as a producer twice, I think. Mm-hmm. Because she wanted to just do blues. I said, I don't do just the blues. I drew R&B. Well, she turned out to do R&B, not blues.
Mm-hmm. So, there you go.
Well, people don't know the Blues Brothers are not playing the blues either. They took blues songs and made them pop.
I always thought they should have been called the Soul Brothers.
Could have been.
Because I think that is more soul music than blues music.
Okay, there you go. It's R&B, soul music.
I mean, the song's called Soul Man. Like, that was the hit.
It was the only hit the Blues Brothers had. Who suggested was that one? I'll tell you that little story of the Blues Brothers. So Duck grabs me coming out the elevator. He says, Carpenter, you got to do something about this. I said, what? He said, man, they're doing a bunch of old blues songs on the sell. I said, what are you talking about? I said, okay, rather than me walk in there and do something, I said, let me hear the rehearsal first. And I did. At the end of the rehearsal, I looked at John and said, John, can you do something people can dance to? He said, you got any ideas? I said, yeah, like something. He said, tell me something. I said, it's like Sam and Dave. He said, you remember this? I looked at Paul Schaefer. I said, you remember Soul Man? I cut down a Soul Man, and Danny comes out of the back with that crazy leg dance he has. So Danny, without knowing that he was doing it, he gave guys a K-dance a reason to get out there on the floor and dance. This is stupid. I'm just copying Dan Aykroyd. That's all I ever do. I think it's cool. He can't dance. He can't sing or dance, but he can carry a tune. He plays harmonica, so he's singing like it did. Dave couldn't sing. It was Sam and Dave. Dave couldn't sing, so Sam had to bring Sam down. Because Dave didn't have any range, but he could dance better than anybody. So as dynamic dude, they were dynamic, all right. I think when they left Sac, they never had another hit because people wanted to hear that Sac sound. It's Sam and Dave fine, but they want to hear Sam and Dave with the Sac sound backing them.
It is amazing how Sam and Dave didn't have hits beforehand or afterwards, and it was only the magic with you guys.
So there was magic there, and after Dave died, Sam went back up. He quit singing the hits so much. He sang them way up. It's like Soul Man. He's got up to B flat now. From G the original song goes G to A flat, and so. I was in the middle of the Belushi song when I got off track. And Belushi said, Ben, it's great, Crawford, but it's too high for me. I can't sing it. I started dropping down to a fourth and to E and started playing an E. And we've been playing there ever since an E. And Sam had, I think Sam played an E, but he went up an octave. So he did an E one time with us. That is B flat to B or B flat to C, I think. Or B flat to B, not C.
Steve, how did how many of the like Booker T and the MG songs started off with like a riff from you as opposed to, you know, like a melodic thing that Booker was doing on the organ?
I think as far as what I knew, Midnight Hour and Knock on Wood are the only two dynamically. Noticed on the radio was the DJs would talk all the way up to the singer sang. No matter how long the instrumental was on the front, they didn't give a crap. They just sang up until the commercial was over, or the songs. So the singer started singing, and then he shut up and let the singer sing. And so I said, I'm going to give them something they can't talk over. So I gave them the power intro of Midnight Hour, the power intro of Knock on Wood. And we had written a song, Knock on Wood. We were so proud of it. We called Wayne on his job over West River. Said, Wayne, you got to get over here quick. So I said, while I'm teaching Duck the song and Rich has a song, you could be teaching the horn parts if we write it now. So that's what happened. And as far as the intro, I said, we couldn't come up. We knew we had a hit song. We couldn't come up with an intro. I said, Eddie, what do you think Midnight Hour would sound like? I said, I don't know. Play it. So I did. I played it starting in E instead of D. Holy mackerel. That was it. It lands you right back on the A. Da, 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 G, A, B, whatever, da, da. Lands back on the A tone, which is to both songs. That's a bridge, four chain. I don't want to lose the four chain. It's a good thing that I got If I Do, which is E. You'll surely lose a lot because your love is better. It's a song full of bridges. Just what it is. Yeah. They think the blues is real easy. Why? Because it's got two or three changes. The trick is very simple. You got to know where to put the notes. And somehow Doug and I figured it out. When we read each other's mind and knew where to go. Because we always listened to Al Jackson. I think Al always knew where to go. Booker just played to us. Booker's one of the greatest musicians I've ever worked with. But I don't think he's a group player. He is a full grooving. He's a group player. Booker's a musician. His main instrument is trombone. But he plays every instrument. He can make a hit out of any instrument. He can play violin, harmonica. All the trumpets, saxophones, flute, he can play it. Plays guitar pretty damn good, too. So a couple of songs that were on sax, I said, Booker, you just play it. Instead of me learning it, you just play what you're playing. He'd write a song, and he'd have all the stuff worked out on guitar, and I'd say, that's stupid for me to learn that. So the only thing that I listened to him, the only album I really listened to Booker was Macklemore Avenue. He dictated every note I played on that album, just about. And he would dictate it. He'd tell me what to play, and I'd play it. And he said, that sounds good. So we did that album with Wally Hyder from the L.A. airport to Hyder's studio. He picked me up and took me straight to the studio and told me everything to play, and I did it. I don't know how long we worked that night on the one album. We didn't work a second night. Just that one day. I was in New York producing another group at the time. He said, when can you be in L.A.? I said, I can't. And when can you be in L.A.? Finally, he just quit calling us. Finally, I called him. I said, look, I'm through. I'll be out tomorrow. He said, well, come on out. And I did. From New York, you got there. If you left in the morning, you got there in the evening, in the afternoon, or late in the afternoon. It's about a five or six hour flight anyway, even though you get some time back. And he took me straight to Hyder from the LAX. Straight to Hyder and told me what to play, and I played them.
How about Time is Tight? Because that was one where, you know, he was doing the soundtrack for that movie Uptight. And then, you know, that just became one of your signature songs and certainly one of your signature riffs. How did that come together?
I don't know. I mean, that was Booker's idea. The Time is Tight thing. That riff was the same as Can't Turn You Loose. And we had a couple of songs that had to look at. It was more of a bass line. It was a guitar line, except the intro and a couple of things in the song.
I think I told you last time that my older daughter, who's now 22, when she was like just weeks old, the thing that would calm her down would be I'd put on Time is Tight and rock her to that beat in front of the speaker. Great. And that was what I got. And if we weren't home, I would just sing it to her. I'd just go do, 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 do. But I was singing your part, so it worked.
So we're doing the Jules Dash film in Paris. That's where we did a musical thing. And Doug, we got home. Doug said, you know, we played Can't Turn the News. I said, what Booker wanted? Time aside, we played Can't Turn the Da 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 da. So the difference in the two songs is da 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 da. There's two notes on two exits on the top of the line. For Time and Sight. Not on Can't Turn You Loose. No action. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
Yeah, it's they're both great riffs. It's a great groove, so worth coming up with variations.
What I remember about Can't Turn You Loose, because Otis wrote that about 10 minutes, and I remember his musician was screaming for the bus. Otis said, if you don't come on, we're going to miss that gig. And Otis said, I'll be right there. We wrote that song in about 10 minutes. And all he did on the end was can da 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 da.
Mr. Cropper, yeah. I was going to ask a question. Didn't Otis Redding produce Sweet Soul Music for Arthur Connolly?
He did.
And you guys played on that?
He played on it. So he told me, here's what Otis told me. He said, I'm going to buy me an apartment and a house in Memphis. He said, I'm moving to Memphis and we're going to produce records. I said, okay. He wanted me to be a co-producer. Okay. Then he died the following week. Oh, that was a shit kicker. Pardon my language. That was the worst thing that ever happened to me, I think, was him passed away. I always looked at him as my older brother. Anything I wanted, I just asked Otis about it. He knew he was so streetwise, you have no idea how streetwise.
So you both play in, you know, and have played in, you know, groups with, you know, Hammond B3 and Booker T and the MGs had a bass. Parlor Greens does not. Delvon Lamar Organ Trio does not. But like, what's the key for both of you in playing guitar alongside an organ like that? Like, how do you make sure you fit in and make everything work?
Okay, let me tell you this story. I've had a lot of engineers tell me, said, man, what do you think of the organ? I said, it's all right. What do you mean it's all right? It's great. It's Booker stuff. I said, no, it's not. You got a mic wrong. You want Booker sound? And I go out and change it. He said, okay, go out and make a Booker sound. I said, okay, and I do it. He said, damn, it sounds just like a Booker playing. I said, I told you. So there you go. There's a trick to that, too. There's a trick to everything. When you say a trick, it's just like cooking. There's a trick to cooking. You can read a recipe, but if you know how to cook, you know what spices to put in there to make something snap or just make it a little different. People love it. They fall in love with it. They make more of that. Okay.
So what's your role as a guitarist in that case, though? Are you sort of like listening to what he does and reacting to it? Or like, how does that, what's the interplay like?
Well, yeah, in the studio I do. On stage, I just put it on and let it rip. Usually in the studio I'm the same way, but I'm always just a Booker. And I play complimentary for Booker. So same thing with a singer. What I do when a singer sings, I complete their lines both times. I seldom play or step on their lines unless it just fits behind it. And what I do, I complete the melody that they can't complete because there's not enough words to complete it. And I play melody more than anything when I'm playing solo. And the thing about my playing is very simple. I have to analyze some of my playing. When the rhythm drops, I'm usually a rhythm guy. When the rhythm drops out and I play a solo, you never hear the rhythm drop out. You think it drops out, but it doesn't. I'm so tight with the rest of the band that the average listener does not feel the rhythm drop out, or the bottom drop out.
That's the same way I look at it. Like, I look at the music bigger than myself, of course, you know, and this, I agree with you, Mr. Cropper. It's like, I just try to compliment and not even try, just do it. I just, you know, compliment with every singer or do a call and response with them, you know, and just try to stay out the way and not be in the way. And so that's how I've always approached it from listening to a lot of, you know, the sessions that you've done and just various stuff, you know, just over that, you know, it's just like, I just want to sit in the cut and just play the part.
Well, most of the stuff that we're known for, we just lucked up on it. We were flying by the seat of our pants. We didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
So Tommy Dow, we fell in love with Tommy Dow when he came down from New York as an engineer or whatever. So he used to give everybody in the band a set of the lyrics so they know what they're talking about, what they're playing about. And I've always thought that too. I said, you know, you just listen to the lyrics of a song and you start trying to play something that sounds like the lyrics of the song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's usually a lot of the stuff that I listen to always does. Like, even
if you
like
do that, you're a winner. In my book, you're a winner. If you do that, that's great. So if there's ever a trick, that's what it's all about. I play to the singer. Always listen to the singer. Any other band members. And most of the guys, I could prove this in one way. We were doing a session at Sunset Sound, I think, and they were so proud of their new sound system or their new headphone system. So it wouldn't happen. So the producer says, let's take a break and then we'll go get something to come back and try it again. So I stayed instead of going to eat with him. And I went into the control room. I said, engineer, can you put that last track back up? He said, you want to hear that? I said, you damn right I do. He said, okay. So he puts it up and it's, you know, it's pretty crappy. So I go around to every phone. There's nothing in there but more me. There's more guitar, more piano, more bass, more drums, more everything. And I said, there's your problem, your new sound system. Everybody's individually can turn themselves up. All they want to hear is themselves. Now, you got everybody to listen to the other band, then you got a groove, then you got something that's happening as a unit. If you just let musicians on their own, most of them will just play it to themselves.
Right.
Yeah. If you play to the singer or either way, both. If you play to the singer and the band, you know you're doing the right thing, I think. That's separate from a musician.
Right, I hear that. Like, I hear that a lot in a lot of tracks that I hear sometimes, like when they put up and the music stands even on its own, you know, and then putting the singer in there and it blends just well. Because, you know, it's more about sitting in with the groove and sitting in with how the music is supposed to be, you know, and feeling it, you know, and just, and that's the thing. I like playing in the same room, which I know that's different now, you know, these days where it's just like people come in, they do one thing, they do another, but it's right. When you're in the same room with each other, it makes so much of a difference, you know, and so much because you're all in the same, you know, you're feeling it together, you know, and you're breathing together, sure. You know, and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I hear that, like, with the bands, like, band I just play with, like, the Paula Greens and my other group, the True Loves, you know, which has horns and stuff, is that we play together, you know, and that's like, I wouldn't want to be able to, like, hey, let's cut this on another time. I mean, because truth be told, I don't really like doing overdubs because it's not my thing. I like, if I can play it, the studio should be able to play right. It live, you know, the same way you
well,
do it in the studio.
Well, when we started a stack, you couldn't fix anything. Why?
Right.
It had to be done on the take. It had to be a mono on the take. There was mm-hmm. no stereo in those days. It was just mono only, and it had to be right.
Right.
So a lot of the stuff gets remixed and put out again, then you start hearing stuff. That's why I buried it, because it sounded bad. I buried it in the mix. If a guy was playing rad, I'd just, when I mixed it or whatever, I just bury the crap out of it. And you used to do that. Nowadays, you can't do that with the new technology. Because Pro Tools and that stuff, here's everything. So I tell a singer sometimes, you know, I mean, a good producer knows when the singer's just done buffing off and not doing his job. Just go out and tell him, say, hey, I know you're doing, you know you're doing this because you're going to redo it tomorrow, but just think about this. He says, what? I said, that mic hears everything you're doing. Every word you're saying, that mic knows. I can make you break it right here. The next couple of takes takes his butt off.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because that's the, like, the sessions that I always do, it's like, if somebody messes up, we do it again from the top until we get it right. You know, that stuff, you know, because I don't want to be like, hey, punch in. I can't do that. It just wouldn't feel right, and my conscience wouldn't let me do it, you know. And stuff. And so it's like, that's what I learned from listening to the records, you know, of, like, you know, Stax and Motown and everybody else. Is just like, okay, we do this until we get it right, you know. I'm not like, here, let's punch in this. It's like, no, that's not how it works for me, you know. And most of the stuff, like, we do is, you know, back to tape, you know, which is great because I like the sound of, you know, getting that dynamic right. sound, you know, not all compressed, you know, and stuff like that. But that's, you know, that's the sound I like. And I mean, plus, you know, for me, you know, with guitar, I usually just plug straight into the amp and that's it, you know, and I just like the sound of the guitar as is, you know. Sometimes every now and again, you know, you might play with a wah or a fuzz or something like that, but majority of the time I like just guitar straight into the amp. And if it needs to be, you know, crank the tubes, then yeah, that'll work out. But
I'm the same way. I like to open up the guitar, plug it in, and if the amp doesn't sound good, I get another amp.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't try to make it sound good. I just make sure it sounds good coming out of the amp.
Mm-hmm.
So, Steve, you have a new album, Friendly Town. Did you record that kind of old school, or did you have to sort of do it more modern?
Old school. Yeah, we were in the studio together. The first one, the Fired Up album, we were in the studio together. Everybody had to overdub and all that stuff. Some of us overdubbed. Billy overdubbed a lot of his stuff. A lot of the rhythm stuff was done on when he wrote the song. But there was three tracks on the album, I think it was the Predator writer. Mm-hmm. He actually wrote. I think he's on all of them as a writer. But there's three that he actually come up with the idea over the riff. The track I came up with. The track itself I came up with. So I'm playing rhythm on everything, just about. And I think I'm playing on all the tracks. But I play solo on a few, but most of them are just rhythm tracks.
And you're saying Billy Gibbons is the one on that?
We were in our studio together on this one. No, on the other one, we weren't. So Roger was there, the drummer was there, the bass player was there, and I was there. So we cut it all live, kind of. Yes. When I say live, it wasn't live. Go ahead.
And you're singing, too.
On some of it. But gosh, yeah, I was doing most of the background singing. A solo one note. that's him, not me. So I listened to the album quite a lot. I used to listen to the albums about 100 times before they released. The day they released, I quit listening. That's it. If it wasn't playing on the radio, I'd hear it again. So that's why I guess I didn't know that Eddie James had covered Champagne and Wine. What is it going to be? All good love, good old sympathy. I remember the night we cut the da-da-da-da-da. That's my idea, but Duck played it. Da-da-da-da-da-da. I walked down. And I think we got to walk down in one of these songs. Da-da-da-da. Yeah.
How much of a difference in Booker T and the MGs did it make when Duck Dunn replaced Louis Steinberg on bass?
All about 200%, that's all.
That's
I love
it?
Louis. Louis was great. Louis played on Last Night and Green Age. And I got Duck from the Marquise when he got off the road. I said, Duck, you're going to have to join. Okay. Because Booker didn't like Louis on the road. And so we had Jim Stewart buy Louis out of his contract. He gave Louis a bunch of money, and Louis was happy to get that. Then he went to Painting House. He was always a little jealous of Duck being there, but it didn't matter. Duck on the stage or something else. Duck turned out to be one of the greatest bass players of the Spaniards ever known. And he was good. And he got good listening to Al Jackson. And I still say, Duck and I both said, Al Jackson is the greatest R&B drummer to ever walk the earth, period. Mm-hmm. And that's proved us by Anton Fig when he was with Booker T and the MGs. He said, have you heard that tape you did in Oslo and all that? I said, no. He said, you need to see it and you need to listen to it. He said, that tells you that Al was the greatest shuffler, greatest drummer on earth. I said, really? So we listened to it. It was a different crew, filming crew. It was French. And it was shot black and white. So there you go. It is what it is. It's going to be what it's going to be.
I was telling Mark in one of the groups, we used to cover a tune called with another group called Tic Tac Toe and Soul Dressing. We used to cover that one. I'm digging deep into your catalog.
That was pretty good, too.
Yeah, it was like, you know.
It was more like a Jimmy Hendrix, like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right. Jim Hendrix is from my hometown.
Ah, all right.
Yeah. Yeah, I read somewhere that you guys met, and he showed you Mercy Mercy by Don Covey.
That's Jimmy Hendrix, yep. Sure did.
Yep.
I said, if you played on anything, I would know you said fiddle a few sets in New York. I said, you played on anything I know? He said, yeah, I played on Don Covey's Have Mercy.
Yeah.
Have Mercy, All Mercy. Have Mercy, baby.
Yeah.
All Mercy was in. So I said, when we get to eating our cheese rolls, can we go across the street to the studio and I'll give you my guitar and you show me that lick? And he said, sure. He takes me, I hand him my guitar, turns it upside down. I said, hell, I can't learn like that.
I just wanted to say this, Mr. Cropper, like, I listened to your work for a very long time. This is like life changing for me. Just listening to you and learning and hearing what you have to say, it's just like I'm beyond words. I'm speechless. So, and I learned a lot from you.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Jimmy. I don't see how anybody's learned anything from me. I play so dumb and so simple. They said, "How come you play so simple?" I said, "That's all I knew was simple." I didn't know any more music. If I'd known more music, I probably would have played more music, but I didn't. And I used the guitar as a tool, not as an instrument.
That's great. I can dig that.
For hammer, probably would have had a hammer in my hand.
Right.
Instead of an axe.
I can dig that.
You guys got to get on a stage together now, because I think that you'd sound really fantastic together.
You got it.
That's the next step.
All right, sounds good to me.
Mark, thank you so much.
That's it for episode 145 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Steve Cropper and Jimmy James for taking part in this one-of-a-kind conversation. Steve Cropper and the Midnight Hour's new album, Friendly Town, comes out August 23rd via Mascot Label Group. You can listen now to the single Too Much Stress, which features Brian May of Queen. For more information about Cropper, go to, yes, playitsteve.com. Parlor Green's debut album, In Green We Dream, also is out, and you can order it directly from the label Coal Mine Records or its retail partner, Plaid Room Records. Follow Jimmy James on Instagram at Jimmy Scratch James, and for tour dates and more, go to parlorgreens.com and truelovesband.com. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who does some of his best work in the midnight hour. For mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again. We're taking an end of summer break for a few weeks, but we'll be back after Labor Day with the next Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.